Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Alessia Sorbonne. I am an honors student and will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. This is the 10th event in our 16th annual Siciliano Forum. This year's topic is the future of higher education. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over 70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Gaming and the Future of Higher Education. Today's guest is Dr. Jane McGonigal. Our speaker is a future forecaster known around the world as a leading innovator in the field of game design, using alternate reality games. She is honored as the Young Global Leader 2012 at the World Economic Forum. The New York Times featured her as one of the top 10 scientists with the best vision for what's coming next. Business Week magazine has called her one of the top 10 innovators to watch. Fast Company magazine hailed her as one of the 100 most creative people in business. Jane earned a PhD at the University of California at Berkeley in her performance studies. Please give a warm welcome to Jane McGonigal.
Oh, good. Standing room only. You guys make me feel so happy and lucky. I really appreciate it. Can you hear me okay? Am I getting picked up by the mic? Yeah. Okay. Let me know. If at any time you can't hear me good, just go like this and I will know what that means. I'm really happy to be here today, especially since I got to meet so many of you at the breakfast. I kind of feel like now I'm just entertaining friends. So thank you for being such a friendly group of faces here. So how many of you already feel like you take games pretty seriously? Can I just see a show of hands? This is awesome. Okay, good. So a lot of times I go and talk to people, and my goal is to convince them to take games seriously. But since you basically already are on that train, what I hope to do today is to give you some information and some ways of thinking about games that will help you in the work that you're doing, help you speak about your passion for games, and help you create games or use games in a way that will truly change the world. So I'm just going to try and share with you everything I can that will make you better able to use games for good. I am probably the most serious game designer in the world in that I do take games really seriously. And I will talk a lot about learning and education today, but this really applies across everything you can imagine, from government to healthcare to happiness and well-being. But we'll think a lot about education today. So I'll just start by sharing with you some of the reasons why I take games seriously, particularly for education. So we know now in the United States that 99% of boys under 18 and 94% of girls under 18 are playing video games regularly, 13 hours a week for the boys and 8 hours a week for the girls. This is really good news. As recently as a decade ago, there was a big gender gap. And there was even, in some parts of the country, regional gaps in terms of economics. But now we see these numbers are consistent across racial, ethnic, and economic stratosphere, and boys and girls are all gaming. So basically, everybody's gaming. And this is good news if you care about using games for positive impact, because it means everybody's coming to them with a basic interest in games and a literacy in games. This is good news. Now, the next stat I'll share with you, not everybody thinks is good news, but I think is good news. We know that 92% of two-year-olds in the U.S. are now playing games. This is extraordinary. Digital games at 2 years old, mostly on their parents' phones or iPads. I really like this picture, by the way. I don't know if you can see the drool coming down. This like perfectly sums up what's going on with games and this generation. So, you know, when you start playing games that young, it will have impacts on the way that you think about the world and the way that you think, the way that your brain develops. And so we are developing a generation of gamers from birth, basically. And in fact, by the time you reach the age of 21 now, most of the people in this room will have spent 10,000 hours gaming. This is true across the United States. Now, 10,000 hours, you know, to put that in perspective, if you have perfect attendance for all of middle school and all of high school, you're only in the classroom for 10,084 hours. So there's a sort of parallel track of education going on where kids are spending as much time learning how to be good at playing games as they are learning everything else. And some of you might also be familiar with the 10,000-hour statistic. If you can spend 10,000 hours doing something by the age of 21, particularly if those 10,000 hours are spent challenging yourself, where you're not perfectly able to complete the task at hand, which is something we're always doing in gaming, right? We're always trying to beat the next level or try a harder goal, then you become like a virtuoso at whatever that thing is. 10,000 hours of practice makes you incredibly good and talented at whatever you're practicing. So we have this whole generation of kids who are virtuosos at gaming by the time they turn 21, certainly by the time they get to college and university. So it kind of, all these numbers adding up in my head, you know, and I told you I take games seriously, I do kind of lie awake at night thinking really deep thoughts about games, and this is the one that has been keeping me up at night most recently, this idea that with these 10,000 hours and the brains are getting transformed from the age of two, is our generation of gamers, you know, are they developing superpowers? And obviously I don't mean superpowers like X-ray vision or, you know, leaping buildings in a single bound. At the Institute for the Future, where I do a lot of my research, we have a definition for superpower that goes like this. It's a skill that so far surpasses any previously demonstrated skill that it effectively changes our notion of what we're personally capable of. And I've been studying, you know, the impact the games have on how we think and act in real life and how we solve problems and how we work with others for more than a decade. And I'm pretty convinced that gamers do have superpowers. So I'm going to share with you some of that research today and some of the ways that we could put these superpowers in the service of humanity. Now, I'm going to share with you a lot of strange ideas and a lot of strange research. And you're going to say to me, Jane, that can't possibly be true. So I want you to feel confident in this research. I want you to be able to go and look it up online after and read all the papers yourself and see, you know, is this persuasive and convincing to you as it is to me. So if you can just remember, show me the science, you can actually go online, just search for that or go to showmethescience.com. And I've collected 100 peer-reviewed scientific papers that you can just click to download and read the whole thing. And so if there's anything that I talk about today that you want to dive deeper in, that's how to do it. And I happen to know that you will remember show me the science better if you all say it out loud. So on the count of three, just like show me the money, you guys know that. I just want you to shout out at me, show me the science, and then you'll be able to find it all later. Okay, so one, two, three.
Show me the science.
Okay, so I'm going to show you some science now. The first science that I want to show you has to do with what's going on in our brain while we play. And I will preface this by saying that neuroimaging is still in its infancy as a science. This is not as direct a science as, say, doing an X-ray and seeing that somebody's bone is broken. But there's a lot that's being learned, and the hypotheses that are being formed are really provocative, and people are starting to validate them in interesting ways. So not as exact as reading a broken bone, but we are starting to see what happens in the brains when people are playing games. So this is literally your brain on games, in case you wondered what it looked like, the parts of the brains that light up when you play. And I want to share with you, this is from Stanford University. I want to tell you a little story about the research they did to get this imagery and what it can teach us about the superpowers of gamers. So this is the game that was being played while that imagery was taken. So see if you can figure out what's going on in this game. Just take a look. So it looks a little bit right, like a typical shooter fantasy game, but as you're kind of reading what's going on in the game, you see that this is actually the environment. It's a human body. You're inside the body, and you're fighting cancer, right? These are chemotherapy weapons. You're fighting the leukemia. This game is called Remission, R-E, Mission, and it was created by a group called Hope Labs, and it was created specifically for young people who've been diagnosed with leukemia. This project has a very interesting history. So they wanted to intervene in a very specific problem. And by the way, I always think games should be designed as solutions to problems, even games that are just meant to be fun and entertainment. So I'll sort of talk a lot about designing games as solutions to problems. The problem that this game wanted to help solve is that young people with leukemia have to take years' worth of oral chemotherapy regimens. And it is really discouraging and difficult to never miss a dose. You have side effects. You want to go on with your life. You get sick of being sick. 3 years of taking these drugs with terrible side effects every day. Kids will just get rebellious. They will refuse to take the drugs. They just forget. And it's really important that you try not to do that, because they've now found that 81% of cases where the cancer comes back happens when somebody has been missing doses of the chemotherapy regimen. So you actually have a lot of control over your recovery, but you have to be willing to stick with this drug regimen, and it's really hard to get kids to stick with it. So they created this game to try to specifically improve the likelihood of kids never missing a dose of chemotherapy. And their theory was they would create this game where you would learn about how chemotherapy worked. You would have this experience of chemotherapy as a powerful weapon that's in your control. It's not something that the doctors are making you do. It's not something that your parents are forcing you to do. It's not something that's just happening to you. It's something in your control, in your power. It is your weapon to fight the disease. You are in control. And they hope by shifting the psychology that they would help the kids stay more engaged. And what they found out was really interesting. They ran clinical trials, a gold standard for medical research. And they found two things. The first thing they found was that the kids who played this game for as few as 2 hours actually had much better chemotherapy adherence. They missed fewer doses. And it's not just they were reporting that they were more consistently taking the chemotherapy. They actually went in and measured 6 months later the level of the chemotherapy agents in their bloodstream and objectively found that they had 20% more of the cancer-fighting agents in their bloodstream than kids who had not played the game. So this was a profound finding, that playing a video game for 2 hours 6 months later had improved by 20% the amount of cancer-fighting drugs in these kids' systems. This was considered one of the biggest breakthrough findings for people who are interested in games having an impact on real life. And it wasn't just the levels of chemo in their blood. It's also higher rates of self-efficacy. So self-efficacy just means that you feel there's something within your control, within your power, that you can do to achieve a goal. In this case, they looked at chemotherapy not as something horrible happening to them, but as something in their control and as something that they could really take advantage of. And if you ask them, is there one thing you can do today to beat your disease, they would say yes, and they would talk very confidently and optimistically about it. So this was pretty amazing. In fact, when they designed this game, they had 30 levels. They thought people would have to play it for an hour every day for a month to have impact. And they had kids play at all different levels. And really, it only took 2 hours on one occasion to have this impact. So 2 hours, 6 months of impact. They wanted to figure out how it was possible that a game could have such a profound impact. So this is where they sent the gamers into the fMRI machine. So this is the actual moving imagery looking at the brain lighting up. And they hypothesized that if we could see which areas of the brain were being lit up, we might be able to have a better understanding of why a game you play for 2 hours could help you do something as profound as beat cancer. And 6 months later, you're still feeling more optimistic. You're still feeling more powerful. So the way they designed the study, they had two conditions, the active and the passive. So the active side is somebody in the fMRI machine playing the game remission. The passive side, you would see, you know, looking at this, you're probably thinking they're just lying there, I don't know, doing nothing, right? In fact, in the passive condition, they're watching somebody else play the game. So they can see the same monitor. They see all of the shooting. I mean, just like you guys were sitting here watching and listening that game. This is what your brain was probably doing. Not as exciting as this. One thing just to keep in mind, you know, as you look at this, besides the fact that, you know, people who worry about video games turning us into brain-dead zombies, I mean, look at the brain of the playing versus the not playing as very reassuring, I think. But also to know that you can't get the benefits of games from just watching them. So I'm always telling parents to stop watching their kids play and start playing with them, or teachers who want to use games in the classroom. You have to actually play the game in order to get the benefits. So no just looking over someone's shoulder. Make sure you're playing yourself. So between these two conditions, active and passive, they were looking for regions of the brain that were really getting lit up by the game, that nothing was going on in the passive watching the game condition. And they found two regions of the brain that were really activated. By the way, this is the geekiest part of the talk, so just bear with me for a couple more minutes here. I do get excited about the brain. So the first part that got really lit up was the caudate and the thalamus, which you guys might have heard that referred to more often as the reward center of the brain. When you see headlines about something being as addicting as cocaine, this is the part of the brain they're talking about. Twitter is as addicting as cocaine. Video games are as addicting as cocaine. What they mean is that this is the center of the brain that lights up when we really want something. The more this region lights up, the more motivated we are. And in some cases, this can be dangerous, like if you're going, if you're gambling, or you are really motivated to get more of a drug. But in the case of wanting to achieve a life goal, we actually like to see this lit up, right? If you're training for a marathon, you're trying to learn how to, play the violin, the more this is lit up, the more likely you are to hang in there until you achieve your goal. So this is a motivation center. When this is lit up, you will not be discouraged by failure. You will really use everything you can to get to your goal. The second part of the brain that's really lit up is the hippocampus, and this is associated with memory and learning. So the more this region of the brain gets lit up, the more likely you are to remember new information or to adopt a new habit and keep practicing that habit. So the researchers at Stanford theorized that this is kind of the 1-2 punch of games. This is like a powerful 1-2 punch. First, you get people really motivated. They're going to keep trying until they master whatever they're trying to accomplish. And you're changing the brain so that they're going to keep that information. They're going to develop that skill. They're going to keep doing it in the future, which is how you can imagine someone plays this video game Remission for 2 hours, and 6 months later, they still feel motivated. They still feel like they have a superpower they can bring to bear on the cancer. So the reward and the memory are really the two things that are at play in the gamer's brain that I think make games an incredible platform for learning anything. So we start with Remission, which is just about learning how to beat a disease. But we'll start to look at other case studies where we can learn to do all kinds of amazing things. Now, when I look at this brain where you've got people who are just not going to give up and they're going to really change their image of themselves permanently through this experience, I like to think of these gamers as super empowered, hopeful individuals. These are people who are not discouraged by obstacles, that are not put off by challenge, and that will bring everything they can bear to their goal. They're optimistic and hopeful about what they can accomplish. And it reminds me of this old saying by a psychologist of play, Brian Sutton Smith. He's been researching play since literally before there were video games. Goes back to the 50s. And he once said that the opposite of play isn't work. It's depression. And I think we're really starting to see this at the neurological level. Depression, we associate it with a lack of motivation and with a lack of confidence in our own abilities. And when we're not confident in our abilities, when we don't have optimism or energy, that sort of motivation that drives us to engage with the world, right? That's depression. Games are literally at a neurological level the opposite of depression. And this is really exciting because if we can motivate and create optimism around anything simply by putting it in a game or creating a game around it, we can bring people out of depression and anxiety and into optimism and feeling super empowered. Now, in the game industry, one way that we like to think about games as being the opposite of depression is just around the positive emotions that they provoke. I think this is one of the most useful pieces of research to come out of the industry in the past few years. This is a list of emotions that gamers say that they seek when they play their favorite games. And it's worth going through sort of top 10 style here. So we have 10 is joy. That's where it's that kind of in-the-moment feeling of everything is aligned and you're doing exactly what you were meant to be doing. Relief, usually we talk about relief in games as being relief from anxiety, relief from anger, relief from frustration, depression, or loneliness. Love is kind of shorthand for the feeling that gamers get when they play with others and they build up trust with the other players, whether they're playing a competitive game together, but they stay in the game until it's complete. They don't quit when it's obvious that they're losing, or when we play a co-op game together and we're actually helping each other to succeed. Seven is surprise, right? We want to be surprised and delighted by what happens next in the game. Six is pride. We're getting better at something. We're mastering something. Curiosity. We want to know what's the solution to this puzzle. What's the next level going to look like? What's going to unlock next on the map? Excitement is a sort of adrenaline going when the game requires a lot of real-time engagement, and we have to be extremely responsive. Awe and wonder is the feeling of, you know, being connected to or a part of something bigger than ourselves. Sometimes it gets provoked by a heroic narrative that makes us feel like we're on this heroic journey. Sometimes it's provoked by being a part of a huge community and you feel like you're part of something bigger. Sometimes it's just the scale of the world, right, and how amazing it is that people have designed something of this magnitude. Number two is contentment. We're just happy with how we're spending our time. We wouldn't rather be doing something else, which it sounds so obvious, but really when you think about it, how often do you see somebody playing a game and they're, like, checking their watch, like, wishing that it was some other time so they could do something else? We have more contentment when we play games than almost anything else that we do. And the last one is really interesting, this sort of feeling of creativity. The number one thing that gamers want to feel and say that they get from their favorite games is this kind of creative agency. It's the ability to try something new, to take risks, to really have the power to make a decision and see what the impact of that decision is, this sort of playful agency. And that's the number one thing that gamers say they want. Now, it turns out that these positive emotions, they're not just things we feel when we play games. They actually change how we think and act after we stop playing the game. So I'm going to share with you some of the top research looking at this. And you can think about this even in the context of remission. You have these powerful feelings for 2 hours and it changes your behavior for 6 months. All of these positive emotions stay with us and change how we think and act in real life. So just to give you one example, we're starting to see that kids who spend more time playing video games score higher on tests of creativity. Really classic tests like the Torrens test of creativity. It's been used for more than 40 years, and it's actually been validated to be able to predict how much respect you will have in your future career as an innovator or as somebody who take risks and actually add something new to your field. You tell stories in the test, you draw pictures. So there's been some great research on this. Michigan State University is doing a lot of it, showing that kids who spend higher hours than the norm playing video games score almost 30% higher on these tests of creativity. And this is true even if they're exclusively playing violent video games. This is something the researchers called out specifically because so many parents are concerned about violent video games, and they wanted to check against that. Even the violent video games are boosting the scores in creativity. And I just find this fascinating because if you ask gamers, you know, what do you feel when you play? The number one thing they say is they feel creative. They feel like they have this creative power. And now we're starting to see that this power seems to be not just an emotion, but an actual skill that's being developed. We know also from industry research that gamers spend 80% of the time failing. I love this because it flies in the face of so many misconceptions about gaming. Sometimes we think that we play games because they're easy and we want a quick win, we want to sort of feel good and successful. But in fact, we spend more time failing when we play games than we do in almost any other part of our life. Right? We don't have permission to fail 80% of the time in school or at the workplace. And it's really remarkable that gamers are volunteering to be really bad at something. We don't do this in most areas of our lives, but in games, we agree to be bad. We agree to fail. And in fact, when we get good at a game, we stop playing it and we move on to another game because we want that experience of mastery and getting better. And that only happens when we're willing to fail. So that willingness to fail 80% of the time is a remarkable kind of resilience that we'll talk about more in a little bit. Nature Journal has done some great rounding up of more neuroscience and educational research. I'll give you just three of, I think, the most provocative headlines. Study after study now, we're seeing symptoms of ADHD disappearing almost entirely for people who've been diagnosed with ADHD when they're playing video games that they enjoy. So people who've been diagnosed with a disability suddenly have perfect ability in a video game environment. People are starting to try and figure out why this is. You can think back to the brain scan and that motivation center and keeping people motivated so that they stay focused. That seems to be, are we doing questions at the end? Yes, let's do questions at the end. I believe 15 minutes for it would be great. So these symptoms go away, and they're able not just to focus in the moment, but actually to set longer-term goals. So think about a game like Minecraft, where you might be building something really epic and awesome, and you're not going to do it in an hour. You have to plan over days, and in some cases, even weeks, to build something. Players are better able to set these long-term goals and actually stick with it until they achieve it. Social gamers, people who are playing games where they have to cooperate, are more likely to help the people they play with in real life, that they are more receptive to requests for help, and they're actually more likely to ask the people they play with for help. Brigham Young University actually had some really interesting research showing that kids were more likely to ask their parents for help with a real-life problem if they've been playing co-op games or team-based games with them. The theory here is that they start to see their parents as allies, and so they're more likely to ask them for help. Gamers with autism show increased social intelligence, the particular kind of social intelligence that seems to be developed by playing multiplayer games is the ability to understand someone else's intentions, what they're planning to do, what their motivation is, and to communicate your own motivations and intentions. When you can communicate yours and understand others, it allows you to cooperate and collaborate and coordinate in real time. This ability to express your motivation and understand others is really dramatically increased by playing multiplayer games. The last kind of cool science that I encourage you, again, show me the science, look it up, it sounds almost too good to be true, is that in clinical trials, casual games, simple games like Peggle, which is one of my favorites, if you don't know it, P-E-G-G-L-E, it's certainly, when I read this, I thought, I'm sure Peggle is doing this for me as well. These games actually outperform pharmaceuticals for treating clinical anxiety and depression. The dose is about 30 minutes a day, and you can have long-term impacts on people's reported mood and well-being. So dive into that research. It's quite fascinating. So when you add up all the studies, what you're starting to see really is that games are making us more resilient in three different ways. They're making us mentally resilient. We're better able to focus on a challenge. We're not going to give up in the face of failure or obstacles. They're making us emotionally resilient. We can provoke these 10 positive emotions even when we're depressed, even when we're anxious. In fact, research has shown that kids going in for surgery can lose their anxiety and feel positive emotions by playing games. We've seen soldiers who are serving in extremely stressful situations can get rid of post-traumatic stress disorder and the feelings associated with it by playing games. Burn victims at hospitals can play video games that treat their pain more effectively than morphine. This ability to provoke these powerful positive emotions is an incredible emotional resilience. And finally, the social resilience, that we're better able to ask others for help, that we're more likely to help others, that we communicate our intentions better. We have this social resilience. So we're mentally stronger, we're emotionally stronger, and we're socially stronger. Now, I could talk about resilience a lot and show you more data, but I realize at some point the data just, that's enough of that, and we need to have a more personal, visceral understanding. So I thought I would show you the faces of gamers while they're playing some favorite games, and I want you to see if you can spot the resilience. This is going to be hard, but I feel you can rise to the occasion. Okay, so it's a portrait series by a guy named Phil Toldano. He's super awesome. You should check out his work online. He set up a camera in front of the gamers while they were playing. And I like this. This is like kind of looks like Michael Jordan going for the dunk. Like that when you bite a tongue, right, the emotion we associate with that is relish, right? So you relish your experience when you feel powerful and confident, but you're doing something that's really challenging, right? So that's definitely a form of resilience. Here we have another face of resilience. I think you would kind of... This is a fierce determination, right, that we would bring to bear on a challenge. This guy, you know, he's having a hard time, but we would consider this, well, we would call this grit and perseverance, right? Sometimes the resilience looks like this. It's what we call the flow state, right, where you're so absorbed in the activity because you have a perfect match between your abilities and the challenge that you lose track of time. This is when the hours go by, you're still playing. This is the face that we often associate with that. This guy's my favorite. I do talk about him a lot because if you didn't know he was playing a game, you'd be pretty worried about him. The nostrils are flared. The pupils are dilated. You know, I think it's fair to say the game is not going well for him at this moment. And he's probably going to fail. But the good thing about being willing to fail 80% of the time and having these positive emotions to draw on is that you hang in there. And I like to think of this as kind of like the before phase. And this would be the after phase, where you get to that feeling of surprise and amazement that you actually did what you were trying to do. And in the games, we often get this. We weren't quite sure we were going to be able to do it, and we surprise and amaze ourselves. And sometimes we call this epic wins, and sometimes we say epic wins sarcastically. But I think everybody has a memory of a game achievement that they accomplished where they really felt like nobody thought they could do it, and they did. And these are really the faces, you know, when I think about games and learning and games in higher education, these are the faces I think that we're trying to bring to bear on the educational experience. You know, what if we had more faces like this in our classrooms or out in the world, wherever we're learning? So I want to revisit this idea of super empowered, hopeful individuals again, because I really think that these are the faces of super empowered, hopeful individuals. And if there's something that higher education should be striving to do, it's to turn everyone into a super empowered, hopeful individual, whatever they're passionate about, whether it's education or manufacturing or engineering or healthcare or art, to inspire people to feel super empowered and optimistic about the change they can make in the world. Now, the good news is we already have a billion gamers on the planet. It's just something I do in my spare time because my goal is to have half the planet be gamers in my lifetime. So we're getting close, and I think we'll get there probably in the next 15 years. And so we have a billion people on the planet who are growing up playing these games, developing this emotional, mental, and social resilience. And when they come together, that's when things get really interesting. So when I think about the future of higher education, I think about all the people who grew up gaming joining forces with everyone else around the world who grew up gaming and trying to achieve extraordinary things together. So I'll just show you three examples of what I think are really inspiring case studies of learning, but it's not just learning something that people already know, but actually making new discoveries, which is what I think education should be in the future. So, and let's talk about these in terms of superpowers. So, they asked you if gamers have superpowers. I will pose to you that they have at least three superpowers. The first of which is to solve the unsolvable. I'm really passionate, particularly in higher education, that students should be learning things that nobody knows, not just learning things that the teacher or professor knows. And Foldit's a really great example of this. How many of you guys have played Foldit? Good, awesome. Make sure, this is my little tip to you, if you would like to someday share in a Nobel Prize, make sure you register for this and use your real name, and I'll explain to you why, but this may be all of our best shot at a Nobel Prize someday. So this is a game created at the University of Washington. It's a protein folding simulator. Protein folding is interesting to scientists because a lot of diseases that we get occur when proteins fold up in the wrong way in our bodies. So think of protein folding as kind of like origami, and sometimes you get beautiful swans, and sometimes you get like big crumbled up junk. And diseases are correlated with crumpled up junk. And we have to unfold it and get it back into the nice, pretty origami shape so that we stay healthy. But the problem with protein folding is that there's so many different parts and they can fold in so many different ways that a scientist described it to me once as like a Rubik's Cube with 100,000 sides. So just like, I know, imagine the existential horror of trying to solve that. So they were using supercomputers to do it kind of brute force style, just, you know, crunch, 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 every possible combination. The computer's looking for nice, stable configurations that aren't going to get unfolded and crumbled up into junk. up. But one day, University of Washington, the researchers thought, you know what, gamers might be better at this than supercomputers because gamers have really good 3D intelligence or spatial intelligence. They can manipulate stuff in space. It's basically, it's like Tetris, right? Pieces have to go together. They have to fit together. And they're really cooperative and collaborative, that they could create a kind of collective intelligence by sharing their strategies on forums and wikis. So they made this game where you learn how to protein fold. And you start out by working on puzzles that have already been solved, right? Scientists know what the right fold is. And then you get to work on things that haven't been solved yet. This is the interface. I will grant you that it's more complex than Angry Birds, but it is not more complex than World of Warcraft, so nobody in this room should be scared off by this. Now, the first thing that happened is they had about 50,000 players play for a few months, and they proved that they were better than computers. They gave the computers 10 puzzles, they gave the gamers 10 puzzles, and the gamers won a majority of the puzzles. They solved them faster than the computers. And they were so excited about this, they published a paper in Nature Journal, peer-reviewed scientific article, and if you go online, they actually list all 50,000 folded players by name, so they now have an author credit in Nature Journal, the most prestigious scientific journal. Now, I have a PhD, and I do not have any papers in Nature Journal yet, so I did not start playing this game soon enough. But there's still hope, because we can keep playing and go for even bigger goals. You might have seen the headline recently, "When scientists fail, it's time to call in the gamers." Gamers unlock protein mystery that baffled AIDS researchers for years. So once they proved that the gamers are better than computers, they just gave them new stuff that nobody had ever figured out. And the gamers were able to solve a problem that has vexed real scientists for 10 years. They solved it in 10 days. By now, there were 250,000 gamers, and they were able to solve the problem. And actually, the team that made the sort of final fold that turned out to be a solution was a team at a high school in the UK. So there's a really clear tie-in to learning and education here. So, you know, I used to say that I wanted to see a game designer nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, but I think that a prize in medicine might be on the horizon even sooner than that. So make sure you spend a little time playing this game, because they listed all 50,000 players as co-authors on the paper. I think that players of this game will be the first sort of crowd to win a Nobel Prize. You do not want to miss out. So that's my tip to you. All right, so another superpower that gamers are developing, I think, is to save the real world, to help tackle some of the most urgent challenges we face, things like poverty, hunger, and climate change. This is a game that I created with the World Bank called Evoke. The World Bank, the problem that they were trying to solve was how do you teach young people in sub-Saharan Africa to feel empowered to make a change in their communities? Can we teach them to start small businesses, social enterprises that will not only create jobs in the community, but also tackle some of their toughest social challenges, like having access to clean water or having electricity? How do we get young people to feel engaged and that they're capable of doing this? So they created this huge online curriculum to teach young people social entrepreneurship. And in 2 years, they had about 20 students complete the course. It was not something that seemed appealing. So they thought maybe a game would be more appealing. And that's where I came in, to try and turn it into a game. So I'll show you a trailer for the game, and then I'll tell you about how it worked.
Are you certain they exist? How can we contact them?
You have to send an evoke.
Show me.
My name is Alchemy, and this is an urgent evoke. Wherever you are, whoever you are, if you found this message, it's your destiny to join us. Humanity needs our help. and you can't solve it alone. Evoke it.
Game's still up and playable, by the way. If any group that wants to play it, classrooms, whatever, you just request access and we let you in. So let me tell you a little bit about how the game works. So we created this graphic novel set 10 years in the future. The reason why we set it 10 years in the future is that when we were doing our research for the game design, we were talking with a lot of young people, high school and college age in Africa. They said things like, I don't really see myself as the kind of person who could do this. Or, you know, we don't really have the solutions, and it's just not, this is not the kind of thing that we would do. So we wanted to figure out a way to kind of reverse engineer the situation. What if we told you 10 years in the future, you are the kind of person who is doing this, and you are a hero to the rest of the world? Can you figure out what happened between 2010 and 2020 to turn you into that person? So in the year 2020, we tell stories about the rest of the world experiencing terrible crises. There's famine in Tokyo. There's cholera outbreaks in London. They lose the whole electricity grid in Rio de Janeiro goes down. And it's young people from sub-Saharan Africa who are called in to rescue the rest of the world because they've spent the past decade learning how to deal with food insecurity, learning how to deal with the need for clean water and renewable and more sustainable sources of energy. And they bring that to bear on the rest of the world. And we knew that this story was really resonating when a young woman in South Africa said to us, this is the first time in my life that I've thought of Africa as being the source of the world's greatest solutions and not just the source of the world's greatest problems, right? So we're trying to use narrative in this sense to really reframe what they could achieve. So if you came to the site, one thing you do is you'd create your origin story. Every week we asked you a question about yourself that would explain how you went from being a normal person in 2010 to this world hero in 2020. Things like what motivates you, things like what are the problems in your local environment that get you really upset that you want to help solve, who are your dream allies, who would you love to learn with or work with, what do you know more about than anyone you know, what are you more passionate about than anyone you know. And they didn't know that what they were doing, but at the end of the 10 weeks, if you complete all these questions, you had this amazing interactive CV or resume that you could use to recruit mentors, allies, or collaborators for your work. We also had you do a mission every week. The missions were based on the story. So the week that we looked at the disruption of the power grid in Rio de Janeiro, we gave you a mission to change the energy source for something you use every day to a more sustainable power source. So a new way to charge your cell phone, a new way to charge the light that you study by. And you had to actually go out and do this. And we gave you all kinds of resources and instructional videos and tips for how to actually make a change locally, and then you would report back with social media, show us through blog posts, photos and videos that you're actually doing this, right? So, you know, here's somebody starting an urban farm the week that we looked at food insecurity and using the photos to actually prove, here I am doing it. Here's somebody who, the week we looked at the power sources, set up a little service for his neighbors, charging their small electronics through the kinetic energy he could generate through his bike, right? So he's putting videos online showing people how he's doing that. Now, we couldn't judge everybody to make sure they were doing it, so we had the players evaluate each other. And for every piece of media another player uploaded, you could give them plus one in one of the evoked powers, plus one courage, plus one entrepreneurship. So this is what one player's profile might look like at the end of the game as they're getting all this feedback from other players. And if you completed all 10 quests and all 10 missions in 10 weeks, the World Bank certified you as a social innovator, class of 2010. So we heard from the players and the students that they wanted something they could put on their CV or resume, something they could show employers that they had actually received the certificate from the World Bank. So we did that. So in 10 weeks, we enrolled just under 20,000 students to more than 130 countries. All we did was, in South Africa, we sent out a text message to a popular university kind of listserv saying free job training and the job of inventing the future. And that was it. And somehow we managed to get all these students. Turns out that people all over the world actually want to help solve problems in Africa and become their collaborators. that since then we've run a lot more students through the game, but that was the one time we had everybody in the game at the same time. Global Giving helped us raise funds for ideas that were generated during the game. I'm actually really proud to say that we have 50 companies that were started by players that are still going to solve these problems. My favorite is called Libraries. Well, it was called Libraries Across Africa. They just renamed themselves to Libri, and they've raised a ton of money to build libraries, a network of libraries across Africa. One of the crazy ideas that you have when you have games, you can think differently. Their idea was, what if libraries were more like McDonald's, which is a weird idea. But they noticed that McDonald's spread across the globe, kind of like a super virus that can't be contained. And yet somehow it was really hard to get libraries set up in Africa. And you could go to, you know, every city in Africa has a McDonald's, but they don't have libraries. So they thought, what would make libraries easier to spread, like a super virus? So they created this franchise model where they will teach you how to set up your own library physically. They have these prefabricated spaces that you can order. And to make it sustainable, you sell snacks or you charge people electronics. So you don't need somebody to give you a grant. You don't need aid from another country. You can actually set up a library and make a living for yourself running the library in your town. If you're interested in this project, they're actually raising money on Kickstarter now. So if you Google Libri, L-I-B-R-I-I, for $1, they will put your name on the wall of one of the libraries, which is, like, really cool. And for $100 contribution, you get to subscribe to whatever they're creating. When they make games, we'll be able to play them. When they write books, we'll be able to read them. So the last example I wanted to share with you has to do with the superpower of seeing the future, sort of making long-term plans and really imagining really remarkable results. And this is a game I created for the New York Public Library. The problem they were trying to solve is that young people don't come to the physical spaces of libraries anymore, even though there are lots of good things that happen in a physical space. For example, this space is gorgeous. When you walk in, you can't help but feel inspired. There's something about the architecture that frees you up to think bigger ideas. But you won't get that from just being online. There's also kind of serendipity of just running into something that you wouldn't have intentionally looked for, or meeting somebody who might become a potential collaborator. So they wanted to bring young people, college students, high school students to the library, and they thought a game might help. So they asked me if I would make a game, and I wasn't sure. I always try to make sure I have a good idea before I agree to do something. They sent me all kinds of materials about the library, and they sent me one thing that as soon as I saw it, I knew I could make a game for them. See if you can figure out why. They sent me this diagram from 1911, which was when the library was first built, showing how they store the books. The library is actually 8 levels that go underground, miles of books underneath city streets. Like, this is real. Like, it's crazy. I didn't know that. Suddenly, the library became much cooler, this sort of subterranean lair. But as soon as I saw this, I'm like, this is great. It's already a game. It's basically like Donkey Kong, right? Like, you can see how you would do this. So I wound up designing an 8-level game where if you got to the top level, you have written a book, and that book goes in the physical stacks of the library. So you become a published author with the New York Library if you finish the game. For me, I always want my games to change people's real lives, whether they're running a business now in Africa or they're, you know, a published author. So I'll show you the trailer for game and explain how it worked. So this game is also still online if you want to take a peek and see how it worked. Couple funny stories about this game. So first of all, they asked me if I would do this. I had this crazy idea that the outcome of the game should be a book that you've published. I didn't want to like give people points for checking out books or achievement badges for visiting collections, because that would be just inspiring you to do what the library wants you to do. I wanted to make a game that would give people a chance to do something they already wanted to do. And we know that a lot of young people want to be published authors. But I actually had no idea when I convinced the library that would be the game, how to do it. It actually took me 3 months after I sold them on the idea, we're going to lock people in overnight and they're going to leave and they will have written a book. They were like, that's amazing. And then I had to go and spend 3 months figuring out how it would really work. But that was fine. That's how I work. I think of the epic win and then I figure out the details later. The other thing that was really funny was we put that trailer online and the board of directors of the library were kind of panicking. They're like, hey, you have publicly committed us to getting 500 high school and college students to spend an entire Friday night in the library. You know, we can't even get like 5 of them to come to the library now, let alone spend the whole Friday night. Are you sure we can achieve this? Because if we don't, you have like kind of humiliated us. But we actually had more than 10,000 people apply for these 500 spots. So that was a relief. We just had you answer a question about fill in the blank. By the year 2021, I will be the first person to, and then you could say whatever you want. Some people said things like to graduate from college in my family. Some people said things like to translate dolphin speech into English. And you just told us a little bit about your dreams. We picked a really diverse group. Here they are showing up at 6 p.m. on the Friday night. We lock the doors, sunset to sunrise. Nobody's allowed out till they write a book. We had them all download an app, and the app sort of guided them around the library, hunting for these 100 inspiring objects. We wanted you to have face-to-face encounters with objects that would change your notion of what was possible for you. They work together in teams, and you can see them here. They're kind of hunting them down. For example, they might be looking for the Declaration of Independence. They have the actual thing, you know, at the New York Public Library. Not just any copy, but you can see here a copy that he was editing while he was writing it. So you can kind of see Thomas Jefferson, you know, rethinking the right way to say something and sort of see the humanity behind making this declaration. So once you found the object, you would scan. We use QR codes because that was the easiest thing to do with that physical space. And to prove that you'd found the object, and then we would tell you something interesting about the object to try to humanize the experience of making history. So, for example, we pointed out that he actually had to scribble out a part that criticized the institution of slavery. So originally Thomas Jefferson was going to make a big stand about how we should also free the slaves. And his peers said it was too controversial to do that at the time. Stick with, you know, liberating us from the UK and we'll deal with the slave issue later. And we wanted to share this because we wanted, the players to see that making history is, you know, it's about courage. It's also about indecision. You don't know what the right thing to do is. How far can you go? How much should you say? And to really humanize, you know, that these things don't just happen, that these are people trying to be brave and trying to do the right thing. So after you had this moment encounter with the object and the sort of humanizing experience, we gave you your own writing quest inspired by that object. Really simple interface. In this case, you saw the Declaration of Independence. Your mission is to make your own declaration. So it's 2011. What do you want to stand up and declare today, the way they declared their independence? Make your declaration and then get 56 people to sign it, because that's how many people signed, you know, the original declaration. That would be complete. So that night, here's one guy completing this mission. He stood up on a desk in the middle of the Rose Reading Room reading his declaration. This was a declaration of interdependence, sort of we need to be more dependent, more cooperative globally and together socially. So definitely a modern take on the Declaration of Independence. And he's trying to get people to come over and sign it. So people worked on these missions all night. We wanted to have a real physical book at the end of the night, so we found this guy in Brooklyn who had been trained in the UK in medieval bookbinding, and so he brought this crazy contraption, and the players are printing out the pages as they write it, and he's sewing them up in real time to make the book. This is what the reading room looked like. 3 in the morning, never looked like that before. Except for, actually, they had an Xbox tournament in the library 1 year, and that was the only other time they said they'd had that many young people in the Rosary Room. You're wondering how they stayed awake till 6 a.m. There was coffee and pizza, but people were creative. This guy brought a vuvuzela. Do you remember from the World Cup, that horn? So he wandered around the library blowing it randomly just to make sure nobody was sleeping. Can't do that normally in the library, but you could totally do it when you're playing a game. So that night, they created 1,184 of these stories, and they were all about visions for the future, things that you were passionate about, that you were committing to making a change. If you made this declaration, you were going to follow through over the next 10 years of your life. So at 6 a.m., they all lined up to sign the physical book. This is their declaration of what they were passionate about and what they wanted to commit to for the next 10 years. We called the book 100 Ways to Make History Volume 1 because the game is also online. You can do all these quests online. We've created 3D experiences of all the objects so you can experience them. And schools and libraries actually have their own volumes all over the world of their own vision. The last sort of epic win thing I'll share with you about this book. Originally, the board of directors said they would put this book that the players wrote in the general research collection, which is, you know, where all the mishmash of books are. But they were so inspired by what the players created that the president stood up in front of all of them and said, "We pledge to defend this book for as long as New York City is standing, and we will put it in the rare books collection next to the Declaration of Independence, next to the Gutenberg Bible." The great benefit of that means not only will they be able to take their kids and their grandkids and their friends to see this book that they wrote, but they have access to the rare books collection as authors. You can go visit any collection you want. You don't need to sign up. You're an author. They're the only living authors for the rare books collection in the United States. So that makes them basically really big badasses. They can just like wander and do that whenever they want. That's a superpower, right? So, you know, do gamers have superpowers? You know, we think about being able to achieve things we wouldn't ordinarily be able to achieve, or bringing more optimism and hope and collaboration to do bigger things. When I think about the future of higher education, I think about students doing stuff like this, you know, whether it's helping researchers solve diseases like Alzheimer's, or whether it's, you know, writing. But why shouldn't every student have a published book by the end of every course? And starting their own businesses and collaborating with people worldwide. That's the future of learning, I think. It's doing and acting together. If you're interested in finding more people doing that, we have a network on gameful.org of people doing that, and you should tweet at me. And I've actually spoken for almost an hour, but I did say I'd take questions, and you were going to get the first question, if you still have one. Did I help? Okay. Well, do we have time for any more?
I think we can take 2 questions.
Let's take 2 questions.
Okay. So please speak directly into the microphone and state your name and give a little bit of information about yourself. You might have to meet me halfway.
Hi, my name is Matt Morissette. I'm a senior here. And I know you've probably heard this question a lot, but they've been talking about violence in video games and how it could be dangerous. Do you believe that?
Yeah, great. Okay, I'll do my best because there's like a million things to say about this. Okay, so first of all, there's a great article on Kotaku, actually, that does a meta-analysis of all the research over the past 15 years. So the short answer is, there are potentially negative effects of playing violent video games if you are playing exclusively against strangers online. So the key elements are strangers and competition. You can play violent video games by yourself, no problem. You can play violent video games with your friends and family on the same team, no problem. You can even, like, you know, be playing competitively with your family, no problem. You can play cooperatively online with strangers, no problem. The only problem comes when you're consistently trying to beat anonymous strangers online. That seems to create more aggression anger and hostility. Not in everybody, but that's the case where you would see negative outcomes. For most people, you see positive outcomes, things like increased, you know, teamwork, better bonds with the people they're playing with, relief of sort of catharsis of anger or frustration or fear. Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston did a great longitudinal study showing that kids who are playing scary or violent games are actually learning to manage difficult emotions like fear and anxiety and anger. It's actually beneficial and therapeutic to them. We know that kids who play violent games tend to have fewer nightmares because they control themselves in dreams like they're an avatar. There's all sorts of interesting positive benefits. The last one is shooter action games improve cognitive abilities in terms of multitasking, in terms of 3D spatial intelligence. So, you know, there are all these benefits. So basically, just avoid being a jerk, which you know who the jerk gamers are. They're just trying to beat people they don't know on the internet. Beat people you know or play co-op with strangers, and then you can enjoy all of the violence that you want. That's the end of that. Okay.
Is there another?
Yeah. Hi, I'm a graduate student in the linguistics department. I'm curious of your thoughts on second language learning and gaming.
Yeah. So right now, there are so many people doing amazing work with ESL, English as Second Language Learning. Things like simply putting players in a World of Warcraft English language server and saying, hey, if you want, we can just spend all of our class time playing this game, but you have to play on an English language server. There's been a lot of published research around that. People are trying to now take that and apply it to other second language learning. So in the United States, where you might see people wanting to learn Chinese and learn Spanish and things like that. So I know there are games that are working on this. Minecraft, they have an EDU project where some teachers are trying to create language learning within the Minecraft environment. You know, I have fantasies of video games in the future. You know, I want to play games that are set in, you know, some apocalyptic future in China, and I have to speak Mandarin to communicate, you know, with my headset on. There are people in the industry thinking, you know, in terms of commercial video games, if there are ways to fit in that kind of real learning as well. But there's good published research showing that the motivating factors, if you can get them in on a server, a social environment where everybody else is speaking a language, you can motivate them to learn. And it's mostly been tested with ESL, but I think could be reverse engineered the other way. So that was two questions. Could tweet at me. I'm not good with email, but I'm good with Twitter. So, and thank you guys. You've been a really great audience. It was super fun.
Please join me in thanking Dr. McGonigal.